You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Marcy Little. Marcy, it's good to have you here.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So, Marcy, the way the show begins is with a huge question. Who are you? What do we need to know about the labels you wear, the values, the things you've aspired to live by, the experiences you've had? What do we need to know just to start the conversation?
Well, I guess I would start by saying how I answer that today is very different than how I may have answered that a year, 2, 3 years ago.
Or 2 or 3 years from now.
Or perhaps 2 to 3 years from now, certainly, right? I feel that at this stage in my life, I am a person who's in a deep process of becoming. And I've been in a transition in my professional life for the past 3 years, brought on by some external circumstances that made me ill. And so I'm kind of excited about what's going on.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and you're gonna. Do you want to say anything? I'm just gonna give a little preview of that transition.
Yeah. So I used to be a language teacher. I was a language teacher for 25 years, and mostly in the public sector. And my most recent gig being at the Lehman Alternative Community School, and. In the process of getting sick in that teaching experience, I found my way to yoga on a much deeper level and have been in the process of healing for the last 3 years. And in that process of healing, I wrote my first memoir, and writing is something I've been doing for many decades. Mm-hmm. And so things have culminated and come to a head. And I'm at a point now where I'm sort of very feeling led spontaneously to be offering my own understanding and my own healing to other women, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. and other people.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Wow. So we will pick up on that and other themes. But you brought some music with you. What should we open with?
Well, I would like to open with a song titled Marcy, written, composed, and played by my husband, Chris White.
Okay. Here we go. Thank you. listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Marcy Little. So, Marcy, my usual question is, given the life that you value now, what were some of the experiences you had to have in order to know how to live it? And in a profound way, you already started us down that question with how you introduced yourself. So the illness that took you out of teaching and sidelined you but opened up a new experience of life, what was that about? And then what is it that you value?
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah. I'm still trying to figure out what that was about.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Because there's a bit of mystery in all of this to me that remains. But
and there probably always will be.
And there probably always will be, yeah. And on some level, I like it that way. Yeah. You know, as soon as I think I really know this, I think maybe I've entered into a dangerous territory.
Well, you stop wondering and start assuming in life. That's my experience.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, living the question.
Yeah.
Twice at the workplace I was exposed to mold in my classroom, and both times I got very sick. The second time I got sick enough to warrant being taken out of work for a considerable period of time while the building was being remedied. And my experience in going back and trying to work again at that workplace was that I had become highly sensitized.
Right.
And could no longer work there. And in addition to that, being in most settings had a level of danger, basically, for how my body had become sensitized. So sensitized now to also chemical off-gassing, people's perfume, shampoo. Maybe they went down into their crawl space before they came into school. Like all these things, that factors that were out of my control.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So. So that was the precipitating incident. So now that you've been triggered, there's no place that's fully safe.
That's right. I'm sort of always walking around with the question mark of, is this okay? Like even last night walking around the festival, Ithaca Festival outdoors,
right.
There were so many triggers and I had to just sort of make my way through that. And
How do you experience the trigger, and what do you mean by making your way?
Yeah, those are good questions. So, for example, walking across a newly paved parking lot to get to listen to the blind spots and noticing that the off-gassing smell of the tarmac had gone immediately up into my sinuses and had the start of a headache that lasted for the rest of the night, for example. Or walking over to the Press Bay Alley area and hanging out with the folks who were jamming and jiving over there, and someone had very, very strong perfume on, and I couldn't get away from it. So I couldn't just hang out there and dance and relax and enjoy myself. And I walked away and it stayed with me. Like it wouldn't.
Once the reaction's triggered, it lasts a while.
Yeah, and also the smell, it's stuck inside of me or something. Mm-hmm. And So
how does yoga intersect with this experience?
Oh, I just thank my lucky stars for yoga. Yoga, the practice of yoga for me is so many-fold. You know, a lot of people think yoga in our Western world now, and they think, oh, I'm going to do all these postures in my body, and then I'm going to, you know, work out and feel better afterwards, and that's definitely true.
Mm-hmm. But yoga refers to 6 or 7 different practices, and they're very different kinds of practices.
Yeah, they are. And the more I practice, the more subtle my practice becomes. Mm-hmm. And the more subtle my practice becomes, the more I have to offer that to the people who I work with.
And what is your practice?
So I have a daily practice that begins with meditation and tuning in.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very mystical moment for me. And when I don't start my day this way, my day doesn't go very well. So if some people may call it prayer.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really want to label it exactly, but I sit with myself in a kind of way where I just allow myself to sink into a deep sort of listening.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some part of me and my personality that melts away. And I get in touch with a deeper wisdom, I would say, a deeper intelligence. And it's from this deeper place that I wish to live at all moments of my life.
Mm-hmm.
But in particular, that practice is something I need to do every time I'm going to be working with other people. So I bring that into my space. And from that place and that way, I become sort of a vessel, a conduit of deep listening, so that I am able to interpret, intuit, see those who have brought themselves into my space so that I can commune with what their healing need is in right. that moment.
So the internal distractions are no longer there.
The internal distractions are not always no longer there. I mean, if I'm doing a good job, they're no longer there.
Yeah, I understand. My practice is to spend an hour with the news first thing in the morning, and I basically meditate or pray over what I'm learning about. And I've done that for 40 years.
Okay.
But it allows me to be centered in reality, but not reactive when it works.
I see.
But if my life is otherwise stressful, I'm just as obnoxious and out of control as everybody else.
Right. But what you're saying, because there's sort of I don't need to check out in order to be really present.
Right. Yeah. And I just become open. Uh-huh.
It's like I really need to check in. Mm-hmm. And I guess too, it's sort of a lifetime of being born into a woman's body, into a caregiver body. That process of checking in deeply with my own self is one that almost feels like a radical rejection of the full matrix of my being on some level.
Why do you say that?
Well, you know, we're born into the families we're born into. We're mm-hmm. born into the society that we're born into in this world, and the way that it's its brand of expectations mm-hmm. and biases and all of those live so deeply and unconsciously in us. And, you know, I was a teacher for 25 years.
Right. Well, the reproduction of the system, as it were.
Yeah. And, you know, and I would say on a certain level, too, my role in my family unit was one of being a caretaker. My mother may not agree, but right. that's my lived experience.
Right. And what's, from the part of the unity of reality that we occupy, from that part, we have our subjective experience. It's not exclusive or isolated, but it is our experience.
It is ours.
Yeah.
So it feels a bit like a radical move every time I sit down on the mat and I give myself permission to take that space, to enter that space, and to live it as fully as I possibly can. And the women, a lot of the women who I work with, struggle with that too. Mm-hmm. Struggle with really allowing themselves to prioritize themselves, you know, make themselves primary.
Mm-hmm.
Re-own this body, this exquisite mix of cells and intelligence.
And how does the practice of yoga help you reclaim yourself?
Oh, it's so immediate. Uh-huh. The second when I get into the actual physical practice, so after I move out of the meditation and I move into the body portion, it's immediate for me. My hands hit the mat and it's meditation and movement, really. Mm-hmm. And so my body, if I'm listening well, is giving me information constantly. And the more that I listen and I respond, the deeper that relationship goes mm-hmm. until there's a fundamental trust that is built. And then keep coming back to just keep strengthening that relationship.
Sure. And how is this different than how you were 5 or 10 years ago?
Who was I 5 or 10 years ago?
I mean specifically the mental and the physical and emotional experience. How is your experience of your life different now than it was then?
Yeah, I think that's a hard one for me to answer because, you know, I really, in many ways, this is not so different than the teacher who showed up in the classroom.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as a teacher, I felt like my first job was just to love my students. And anything else that took place in the classroom was sort of frosting on the cake.
Right. But you used the word to show up in the classroom, which was before loving your students uh-huh. in the way that the meditation or the peace in the yoga happens.
Uh-huh. Now I feel a little bit lost up by the question.
Oh, no. It was an observation. It was just like showing up in the classroom was where you started, and then the first task after that was to love your students.
Uh-huh. Well, that's true. And even during those 25 years of teaching, I had a morning practice.
Mm-hmm.
And I would use the morning practice very often. There were different Buddhist prayers, for example, if I had a very challenging student, that I would evoke for myself to wish loving kindness and to free myself from my own reactivity that could get stimulated. So as, in a sense, I've been practicing this for many, 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 many years. And in the process, I taught language and I made great, you know, made things fun. And I had deep relationships with so many of my students, which was the most important and the most rewarding part of the job.
Right.
And that continues to be true as I
teach yoga.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the connection I was making. But how has your experience of your life changed? Because that seems to have been...
Well, I have to say, so living with now an invisible disability means that everything is different. And there's a kind of a limiting factor that's present at all times.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of a question of, is this going to be viable? Is this going to be viable? That I never had to live with before, number one. You know, I could go anywhere and just be a full participant in the world. And
no limits, in effect.
Yeah, no limits. And now there are. And what does that mean? Well, I have a studio in my home where I've been able to curate the air, so to speak.
Sure.
And when I have conversations with people, sometimes people in my family who still live in a different paradigm of this is how life is supposed to look. You know, you go to college, you get a job, you make a living. When you're 50, you're supposed to be in the years where you're making your biggest salary.
Mm-hmm.
Then you retire.
Right.
And I've fallen out of that matrix completely.
Yep.
And so, yeah, I'm still trying to figure it out.
Yeah. But it sounds like you are attentive to your physical well-being constantly now in a way that you weren't before. And the way you manage that is with the awareness or the body memories that come with yoga and meditation.
Mm-hmm.
I'm being a little interpretive here, but it seems that's what you're saying. And it didn't have that hold on your life back when you were teaching.
It's true. It's a very different process now. Yeah. There's much more spaciousness, and you brought up body memories, which is very, very much what this is about.
Yeah.
It's like, what do I discover? What do we discover when we slow it down and we move into ourselves? And I think of the body as being, for most of us, a place of unconscious.
Mm-hmm.
And when we do slow down and enter it, the information and the wisdom that we get there is plentiful.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We are grounded. Let's take a break for music. What should we play next?
How about we play a song that was composed by my son, Zachary Charvelin. One of his art forms is electronic music.
Mm-hmm. And which one would you like to play? Is there one in particular?
I don't have one in particular. Why don't you choose?
Okay, I'm going to put the plea up.
Great.
Oops, hang on a second here. I just seems to have... Sometimes these work easier than others. Okay, this should be fine. Thank you. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Marcy Little. So, Marcy, what are some of the things that you had, that you experienced that you never would have chosen, but you had to, because of just how your life has played out? and how have you changed because of them?
In many ways, my life seems guided by fate. When I first became pregnant with my son,
does that mean that there is a narrative that you just feel compelled that you're living into, or and that you're out of control of, or is it fate giving you these circumstances?
I think fate has given me many circumstances, and then has sort of stood back and said, "Okay, how are you going to live this? How's she going to do with this?"
Yeah.
The first one is my son, born in 1997. Zachary, who composed that last tune, was born with Duchenne's muscular dystrophy, which we learned about when he was about 3 months old, which is uncommon. And I was 28, going on 29 at the time. And so, boom, you know, this, I didn't get to live in that usual fantasy that parents live in about having a child and what that's all going to mean and the trajectory. And I remember learning about it and sitting with Zach as a baby and holding him and touching his skin and wondering what is it going to be like as his condition and illness progresses to continue to be able to touch his skin.
Right, right.
How is that going to change? Am I going to be able to keep touching his skin? It felt so important at the
right,
time.
Right, and what's the reactivity or the lack of, I don't know the disease specifically, but
Yeah, Duchenne's muscular dystrophy is a progressive muscle wasting illness. It's genetic. In this case, it was a genetic anomaly that occurred in one of my eggs when my body was being made in my mother's body. And at the same time, I have to say that this truth about Zach and this truth about us meant that I had to grow up very quickly. Uh-huh. It pushed me to become an adult in a way that I probably never would have known or had to show up for.
So what did you have to change? What did you have to do differently? Feel, think differently?
My 20s were characterized by me living every one of my questions fully. And it took me...
With abandon.
With abandon.
Yeah. That doesn't surprise me.
Yeah. Every question. If I had a question, like, oh, what would it be like? And then I'm living in Hungary with, you know, a man from Trinidad and we're teaching English and boom, 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 et cetera. So the first thing I think is that it grounded me. Mm-hmm. I began to live at Eco Village in Ithaca, which was a really smart decision because the notion of living in an apartment downtown somewhere isolated as a single mother, and Zach's dad was back in France, was untenable to me. Mm-hmm. And so I got pulled right in there, and it ended up being the most wonderful of choices, the kind of community that being there offered throughout the years. Mm-hmm. We all grew up together, really. You know, our kids grew up together. We grew up as adults together, making consensus based decisions that were hard, learning how to live with other people and in conflict and in harmony and how to work things through. So, and then also just the experience of being a mother to someone like Zach is such a different kind of journey. And when other parents' children, and I get a little emotional, experienced their milestones, for example. And Zach, of course, has always had milestones and always will because he is so alive. But at the same time, there is always a loss of mobility, a loss of strength, a loss of ability to do things, a loss of independence. And And then there's just sort of a kind of a chronic grieving process that mm-hmm. is part and parcel of that story.
Right.
And it's very isolating because there's so few people living that kind of a story.
And I imagine mobility makes it so that it's hard to not be isolated just in terms of contact with other human beings.
Entirely. Yeah. You know, when his friends began to run in packs,
right,
they left him behind. Or if they had gatherings at their houses, he couldn't get in the door, you know, once he was in a wheelchair,
right,
for example. Or just even coming downtown and trying to get into restaurants or go to a restaurant where he could use the bathroom.
Right.
The upside of this is that it has created an awareness in me around, a deeper awareness around what it means to be part of one of the groups in society that lives oppressed, really, and doesn't have the same access to everything, basically.
Well, yeah, or access to what, in some sense, is needed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can put it that way.
Right. I mean, even by thinking one way versus another, when it doesn't matter, we've oppressed the other in the most subtle sort of way. So I just was reacting a little bit. We do not include people, and that is our lack of consideration. And that's something to be extremely mindful of. And there are times when we actually oppress people, but the two are a little bit different.
And oppression in this case has come in so many forms. There's obviously that just the physical exclusion
sure.
from space,
yep. Yep.
But it's also people's lack of comfort with somebody who looks like Zach in a wheelchair, and that sort of unconscious hidden bias of
the reactivity that they're not even aware they're showing.
The reactivity, and also just not even seeing him yet as a full person.
Right.
That's the big one, you know. But this aspect of our lives brought me right into having to become a fierce advocate.
Mm-hmm.
And so I developed some pretty intense advocacy skills.
Both some mama bear skills.
Mama bear skills that have translated and transcended all kinds of areas of my life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And helped me also to connect with other folks, other groups.
You grow up. Did your modeling advocacy for him help him to learn to advocate for himself?
Yes, I think so. We created a committee at the Lehman Alternative Community School, where he was a student and I became a teacher, called Students with Disabilities and Their Allies.
Mm-hmm.
And I began it and worked very closely with Finger Lakes Independence Center. And they came in and we did trainings and we did empathy building
mm-hmm.
exercises, had kids sign up to like spend 24 hours in a wheelchair or blinded or, you know, all kinds of things. And gradually Zach took over the leadership of that committee and he began to organize things as like panel mm-hmm. discussions, bringing people in a all school assembly so the students could ask questions. And it was just really about raising awareness.
Mm-hmm. Neat.
Yeah.
Neat. So becoming a mother made you an adult. Becoming a mother of a person who would experience losses growing up more as much as experiencing gains, or
mm-hmm.
but maybe not anymore necessarily at all, but significant losses made you grow up.
It really did.
Right. So how is the Marcy who was the young mother different now than the young mother who reacted?
Oh my goodness. Young mother Marcy was just fantastically motivated and driven and angry.
All in and all angry.
And all angry.
Got it. It sounds like a rather explosive combination. But I've actually been there. So.
I mean, so yes. And also, I think she really didn't know how to recognize emotion when it was coming up first,
mm-hmm.
or how to give it space.
Right.
And so this process of grief could not be ignored, and it just would come in like a like a tsunami, really. Right. It cannot be held back.
Right, right.
And gradually and slowly over the years and working with that has helped me to soften and learn how to listen. And the yoga practice in particular has been, you know, instrumental in this. But becoming more subtle so that things don't have to get so big inside before I can be attentive to them and just feel what needs to be felt and move on.
Yeah.
It sounds so simple, and yet.
Well, I mean, when you have been launched like a rocket into this need to make things happy and follow your curiosity and the seeking behavior that comes with excitement and keeping and being all in all the time, then to learn how to grieve cuts you off at your knees to grieve, because that's like, you know, that's the hell you don't go to. It's not simple at all. Mm-hmm. Let's cut to music and we'll come back to these themes.
Okay.
What should I play next?
Next, I think you should play Come Away With Me by Nora Jones.
Okay. Here we go.
Come away with me in the night. Come away with me and I will write you a song. Come away with me. Come away where they can't tempt us with their lies. And I want to walk with you on a cloudy day in fields where the yellow grass grows knee high. So won't you try? Come away with me and we'll kiss on a mountain top. Come away with me and I'll never stop loving you.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Marcy Little. So, Marcy, you talked about how becoming a mother made you, you know, become an adult. But you've also talked about how the sensitization to molds and other chemicals in the environment has also made you take care of yourself in ways that you hadn't before. And all of this is opening yourself up to a life that can deal with a whole range of positive and negative experiences. And now you're working on a book. Mm-hmm. How does this add up to the book? what is the teaching that you want to be doing about now?
So I'll just back up a little bit and say, in 2017, in April, I went on a healing journey to Mexico, and I worked with some shamans. And it was at that point that I think I really knew that I wouldn't be going back to teaching, and I certainly wouldn't be going back to those buildings anymore. And so it was sort of a transitional healing experience for me. And like all healing experiences, you don't really know what you're going to get out of it or what you're getting into. Like,
right. Just know there's no other step than you can except across that threshold.
Yeah. Take a leap of faith and move into the mystery, basically. And in moving into that mystery, I came home to discover a aspect of myself that still needed healing, which I thought I had healed, basically, and that is young Marcy, who was sexually abused. And it came in a whopping hurricane in the night, this whole vision of what I was being asked to write about. And I knew that I had a memoir I wanted to write, but I didn't know that this was what the topic was going to be.
Right.
So I came home with this sort of gift and imperative, I guess I would say. Yeah. It was like
a blessing and a curse all at the same
time. All at the same time. And it continues to be that way until it gets published. I'm experiencing it that way. If I move too far away from this project, I don't feel good.
Right, right.
There's like some people call it the daemon, you know, the daemon that that comes in and whew. So anyway, I began writing furiously, and it corresponded to the continuation of my yoga teacher training and the starting of my yoga teacher offering in my new studio. And that cellular level presence in my body and the daily practice of that and the daily practice of going walks and listening for what the healing messages were just informed my writing. And from April to November, I wrote almost daily what was coming through and what wanted to be written, the insights and the healing process that I was going through. And my husband, like it or not, was an integral participant because we're talking about sexual abuse and trauma healing in the body, and you can't really do that alone.
No.
So
and sometimes it's with a partner, it's charged because it brings everybody's experiences, good or bad, up to the table.
It does. Yeah. And I feel blessed in that I have a partner who's been 100% game to walk this walk together, so that we're both learning and growing all the time and coming to deeper and deeper truths and ability to be honest and alive with each other in our bodies and in our hearts. So the final word came in November, and then since then, that was 2017, I've been working on edit, and most recently finished my fourth edit with an editor. And I'm ready to move towards publishing. And a very wise friend who has several books published and has tremendous success as a guru in the business world, as I talked to him about my project, said, "Marcy, look for the patterns in your healing." And they're there. So I've begun the process of going back to my memoir and pulling out what the patterns of healing are, and in the hopes of finding there's something more universal in this process that ultimately I can offer to other women.
Sure.
And it's happening. It was immediate. Because it's a memoir, it's not a how-to book. It's a story.
Right.
But in that story is the process.
Right.
Yeah.
And I want to get back to what you learned, but I also want to just say, I come from a culture, that was still steeped in late 19th century visiting practices of telling your stories in the presence of other people and really telling your stories. I mean, the bullshit was not particularly appreciated. It was not about bragging. It was also not about hiding. And in that story space, you learn how people learn to live as human beings, specific human beings. And that's where the teaching happens. It's not an abstraction. It's in that. And so in that kind of verbal storytelling, visiting culture, was what I was raised in. And so this show is a little bit like what it is, in part because of that. And you can extract aphorisms, teachings, all sorts of things from those stories, but they have to be grounded in the lived experience.
Exactly.
Yeah. So what are you discovering? Or are you ready to talk about what you're discovering?
The first thing you said was the need to have an audience for your story, in a sense. And with a story like sexual abuse, there's this legacy of secrecy and isolation. And even I still notice this working in me today. To even be able to say it out loud is still a struggle.
Right, right. And we have this rhetoric of confidentiality and privacy that so parallels secrecy that it's really hard to know how to be personal and out there without violating that.
Mm-hmm. So I think the very first thing in my storytelling is saying it and saying it out loud. And then being present to what sensations come up for me in my body, or where is there contractions that occur, what wants to move away from that, and then the process of moving toward that. And
when I hear you say this, it's like the first step is saying it out loud to yourself, by yourself, and then progressively
I feel like part of the work is normalizing that, being able to say that pretty much anytime, anywhere. And in doing so, it takes away the power that it holds in the body, in our lives. And we get ourselves back, you know. It's like, as long as it's still hard for me to say this happened or to say this is part of my story, It
has
owns
some control
me.
Over you.
Yeah. So as I come up with sort of a curriculum or a process for helping other people move through, come to identify, you know, where are the places that I am still inhibited or not free, or experience harm in my own self and in my own life. I just lost the train of my thought, but I think I was going to. Am I able to?
It's a process of freeing yourself to actually the impact on you as you say more.
Yes, and so I see that in the training I would like to offer is the first bit is this: can I speak this truth?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. Can I shout this truth?
Can I whisper this truth?
Can I whisper
can
this
I
truth?
Can I speak this truth? Can I shout this truth?
Yes.
Can I hold this truth as a knowledge to myself, but not as a secret?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Right.
Then it has no power.
Right. And in so doing, invariably, shame is going to arise. As I well know.
Yeah.
And I think as probably most of us well know.
Right.
You know, it doesn't have to be sexual abuse. We all have areas that stay somewhat secret that are hard to talk about, and there's usually a component of shame involved.
Yeah.
So I think that's really step one, you know.
So that being able, encouraging people, there are two ways to go here. Being able to say it and becoming increasingly comfortable and realizing that its hold on you still indicates you have some work to do.
Mm-hmm.
That may be with us, any of us, all of our lives. Next we could go is, how do you handle other people's responses? Because many people aren't used to responding to this as a matter of fact sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to normalize it, it has to be a matter of fact sort of thing, and walk them down from either their judgment or their dis-ease. That's got to be part of it. And then there's the next steps, whatever. But that's the first thing that came to my mind. How do you do that?
Good question. I think we'll find out. I think I'm gonna understand how that's done in the doing, and I'm not quite there yet.
Right. But you've been doing it some with small groups, and I imagine in your yoga work.
I think so far, to be honest, it's, you know, in the writing of this memoir, I've kept the content very close to my heart, mm-hmm. and I'm just beginning to tell people what it is.
What you're doing. I got it.
Yeah. Just at the very start of that. And it's still hard.
Yeah.
It's still hard. And I recognize right now, especially in our society, there's such a need for it and such a call for it. And interestingly enough, the inspiration for this memoir came in right before Me Too erupted.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, sure.
So the timing was interesting.
So what I'm wondering particularly is, what are the lessons you were asked by your mentor or a friend to read for the patterns? As you've spoken, you find yourself freeing yourself of the secrecy, and you're becoming more alive as a person and more real as a person. What's the next thing you're learning?
As you were speaking, I was just realizing, oh my, I'm talking about this
on
the radio.
This is yes.
I can't take it back now. It's
right.
out there.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And in a certain sense, this is.
And I don't want to.
And this is what you've lived toward.
Mm-hmm.
And part of this show is making it possible for people to say things that are personal, but they're not secret and they're not private. And mm-hmm. we need to have those conversations and to model how to do it.
Mm-hmm. What I was going to say next had to do with, I keep losing it. My mind is going a little astray at the moment. Yes. This particular memoir and the story of it, the way that it's written, the very vulnerable and expository nature of it. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm very open here. You know, there's you're going to read about sex.
Right.
It's not hidden. In fact, that brings me to the title that I'm working with right now, which is Naked.
Mm.
I have been searching for true stories about what it's like to be a survivor of sexual abuse in her body, in the midst of a sexually intimate experience, and how it's truly lived. And I have yet to find it truly depicted in an honest way that I can relate to anywhere, Eric.
Right.
Which is why...
Go ahead and finish that line.
I was just going to say, which is why I felt so compelled to write this.
Right. And what is missing in the accounts that are out there? Because there are many references or accounts out there, but what's missing?
Yeah. What I see everywhere I go is a very penis-focused sexual experience that has always to do with, hey... We're turned on. We're in bed. Now we're having intercourse. Now we're done. And there's so much nuance about what it really means for two people to come together and what consensus really looks like.
Right.
And the consensus process doesn't stop at the very start of a union. It is a constant throughout the whole experience, which doesn't mean that we don't get lost in it,
Which is fine and
souhaitable, as we say in French.
Right. You get lost in it, but you can also get expelled from it.
I don't know what you mean by that.
By having a sudden reaction you hadn't anticipated that takes the intimacy away.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but you're there in a process.
And that's part of the intimacy.
Yes.
When you have that experience of suddenly, I'm expelled from this.
I'm no longer in the garden, as it were.
In the garden, as it were. I'm no longer where I thought I was or where we thought, or this agreement of where we were headed is no longer en marche. It's no longer moving in the same.
Right.
And then that becomes the intimacy.
Right.
Is to pause right there and to explore that and what needs to happen right now so that we can come back to what is a germane garden for us.
Right. Right, and pausing is the difference between abusing or participating in your own abuse versus making the next step happen.
That's right.
Yeah,
and the fundamental trust that is lost at the time of the violation, I like to call it a breach of the body boundary.
Right.
There's a trust also in the self that is lost because the self somehow was not able to stop that. And then it can create these patterns in the body of perpetuating.
Right. Yeah, and I think, yeah, and the self can be able to accept not stopping it, but to not question it is to betray oneself.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so that brings us back to this practice of yoga and the practice of listening and staying with, so that when that arises, you have a practice where you're really listening. And it's like, hang on, something isn't working right now for me. I don't feel aligned anymore. I've gone out of my body.
Right,
hey,
right. Yeah.
Pause.
Absolutely.
Yes.
So you've actually led right into the closing question of the show, which is by the crisis in the health around the mold issues, environmental issues, by the parenting, by the yoga practice, you have learned how to take care of yourself, or you are by way of learning how to take care of yourself emotionally, intellectually, physically,
spiritually.
So, spiritually. And for me, the three add up to spiritually because of the way that they combine mysteriously. So yes, we're talking the same thing. How do you start the day out with meditation and yoga, but how do you know throughout the day, and how do you attend to yourself now that you have this much more subtle awareness of the consent we need to make to the life we live?
It's a constant negotiation. In yoga, one of the things we talk about is pulsation. And this pulsation of forgetting and remembering is one of them. And just to be honest, I'm just still a human, you know, and I'm practicing.
Right.
And then I'm forgetting to practice.
Right.
And then I'm like, oh, wait a minute.
Yes. And is there a pattern to when you remember? Oh, is there a pattern to what provokes that oh response?
Yeah. Most recently, it's, whew, I feel really ungrounded. Like, oof. I need to sit
with
myself.
So you feel awash a bit.
A bit like I've lost my my compass, my internal compass. And it's like, okay, what do I need to get that back again? And often it's a matter of just stopping, feeling my feet on the ground, getting in tune with my breath, noticing sensations in my body.
Yeah.
And then if I am also with my husband, asking if he'd like to join me in that. We can do that together before we make our next move together.
Right, right.
So we're moving from this place.
Right. So how do you indicate to him that you've identified the need? Before you ask him to join you, you have to kind of let him know, I'm a little off the rails here. How do you cue that?
Like instead of just getting angry and blowing up at him or something?
Or withdrawing, which are the two extremes of the same kind
or
of...
Or with what?
Or just withdrawing.
Withdrawing.
The two extremes of the same thing. But some people just, you know, how do you cue... Or have you become comfortable enough that you can tell him that this is where I'm headed?
Yes.
And now do you want to join me?
Chris and I, on a meta scale, have done many rituals around this and commitments to this work together as a couple. So it doesn't take much for me to say to him, whew, can we just sit down and breathe for a second here? And then we do.
So what you said you've had a commitment and done a lot of work. What is the work that you've done? What are some of the rituals that you have employed?
You have to read my memoir.
Well, there's that too. Yes. Mm. Okay, good. Fair enough. So, is there anything else about your daily practice of self-care that you'd like, that would be important for us to know? Exercise. I mean, yoga is a form of exercise, but anything physically, emotionally, or intellectually that we haven't really...
About me personally?
About your practice.
About my practice?
Yeah.
So a day without a walk in the woods is...
Is not a day.
Is not a day. It is not a day. Yeah. And a day without a walk in the woods where I remember to stop at the stream and listen is also not a day.
Right.
So there are different levels... qualities of being in the woods, so to speak. And it's a nice metaphor also.
Yeah. Yes. Being in the woods and not entirely of or lost in the woods. Yes. Marcy, it's been wonderful to get to know you.
Oh, thank you. You too, Eric.
What should we close with today?
All right. I'd like to close with a song that came up as I was talking to my son about songs that I'd like to bring up onto this show. And we just both started singing it almost simultaneously. And that's Tom's Diner by Suzanne Vagan. It's something we used to sing when he was a child, and we both just knew all the words, and it was so lovely. So,
and he can sing. He hasn't lost that capacity.
Oh, no, he has a fantastic voice.
Beautiful, wonderful. Yeah. Here we go.
She's hitching up her skirt, and while she's